What you need to know today about Iran, about J.D. Vance, he said something really fascinating. And the Tate brothers, yeah, the Tate brothers are in jail right now.
If you have a message which is counter to any of the messages they push, then they have to make people talk about something else other than your ideas. So I was politically attacked.
They weren't punishing me for anything I ever did. They were punishing me for, I think, my opinion.
Sir, at a certain point, if everybody is lying, sir, you have now said the ambassador is lying, the IDF is lying,
the U.S.
Let's say certain elements of the Israeli government want to criticize the deal or have disagreements about the deal. American leadership allows that influence to affect their judgment and to affect what they are advocating for. That's what really bothers me.
Yes, it should bother you, Mr. Vice President. And yes, it does happen. Happens all the time. This is the effect. Let's do this. Hey there, I'm Rick Sanchez. Millions of you are watching, and we want to thank you for being with us here night after night. Really, we do appreciate it. I find myself this morning thinking it's impossible to ignore what is a big story, because people over the weekend, people out of the blue were like calling me, right, to tell me about the, did you hear what happened? Did you hear what happened? They kept telling me. This seemed to be what everybody was talking about. So look, here it is.
The British boxers turned social media influencers Andrew Tate and his brother Tristan have been arrested in the United States.
Controversial Manosphere influencers were arrested by federal officials in Miami.
Manosphere influencers Andrew and Tristan Tate arrested by U.S. Marshals in Florida.
Controversial social media influencers Andrew and Tristan Tate have been arrested in Miami on new charges.
I like that term, Manosphere. Never heard that before. By the way, we have the video of the actual arrest. Look how surprised he looks when the when these agents all of a sudden come up on him. You're going to see this video coming up right here in just a little bit. It's interesting what he's wearing, too. Look at that. Yeah, that guy right there with the tight skin, purple shirt, and what almost seems like women's yoga pants to just above his knees, I guess, or below his knees. That's Andrew Tate. Weird outfit for a guy who professes macho-ness and macho maleism, or whatever the hell it's called. But you know what? Hey, to each his own. And that's his brother. He was wearing a fedora when he was arrested and like what looked like a 1950s-style mafia suit. Yeah, that's the video. I mean, all of a sudden, they arrived in Miami, and these agents just showed up and said, we're taking you away. You're going to prison. You're going to jail. They were busted, of all places, in my hometown. And by the way, let me just say this straight out, because I think this is important as well. I've always given the Tates the benefit of the doubt. Right? Their shtick or their ideological messaging about men in Western societies being systematically emasculated. I know a lot of people think that's insulting in Western media. I actually think they have a point, right? They have a point about that, right? And I'll tell you what, go to the United States, turn on a TV or go to the movies, and you'll see what I'm talking about when you make the argument for male emasculation, like men are weak and are supposed to act weak, right? And I think they have a point about that. So, yes, I'm obviously aware of the accusations against them, though, in Romania. And that's more serious. But those also seem to cut two ways. I looked into that. Were the charges serious? Yes, they were serious, but also somewhat vague. They describe what they did as sexual exploitation schemes without much in the way of specifics. What's worse, the Romanian prosecutors failed to produce a trial, failed to produce a conviction, and an appeals court in Romania questioned the government's evidence. So when I sat down and I talked to them, I said, look, tell me what really happened. And, you know, I gave them an opportunity to explain what happened. A lot of you guys got mad at me for doing so, but I thought it was the fair thing to do journalistically. Here's their response.
It was a matrix attack, and the primary objective of it was to attach heinous allegations to my name so that people talk about the allegations instead of my ideas. I think that in the Western world especially, there is a very serious concern regarding revolution. And they want to try to keep a control on the young masculine men of their populace. Mm. And if you have a message which is counter to any of the messages they push, then they have to make people talk about something else other than your ideas. So I was politically attacked.
They weren't punishing me for anything I ever did. They were punishing me for, I think, my opinions and what I said and what I was doing completely unrelated to that.
All right, so there they're talking about what happened to him in Romania. Now, these new charges, It seems like they've got a more serious problem on their hands. So they flew to Miami, and as soon as they arrived, they're arrested by U.S. federal marshals who were asked to do so by the British, who now want them extradited back to London. And the charges that are being brought by the U.K. do seem more serious. The evidence seems much more specific compared to the Romania case. And on top of that, there are new witnesses that apparently have come forward, and apparently those new witnesses are going to be willing to testify against them in court. So here are the charges that I'm talking about. Let's talk about Andrew Tate first. Faces 7 rape charges, 3 trafficking of sexual exploitation charges, 3 charges of causing bodily harm, and 19 charges of indecent images of a child and extreme pornography. Tristan Tate. He faces only 2 charges of rape, 1 charge of sexual assault, and what's it say there? 3 charges of arranging trafficking for sexual exploitation. In all, if you add everything up and the charges and they multiply, the Tate brothers now face 59 charges altogether, 42 against Andrew, 17 against Tristan, allegedly perpetrated against 7 alleged victims. Look, the Tates' biggest hurdle will probably be these, not just the new evidence, but 4 new witnesses. 4 new witnesses who apparently or allegedly have come forward, and they are expected to testify against them. But really, the strongest testimony in this case that prosecutors, I guarantee you, they're going to introduce at the trial is what Andrew Tate apparently published or wrote himself, his own words, on his website. There was an exclusive story written by the New Yorker. There, reporters at the New Yorker found these passages where he advises young men on how to take advantage of women. He reportedly actually refers to the class as a pimping hose degree, like a degree in how to pimp hose. Yeah. The article, based on archive material and private messages, also details how women should first be seduced and then made dependent, and then separated from their existing support systems so they can be used for making money off of them. That's not good, if they're his words. Lawyers for the Tate brothers say they are innocent, and they say that they're going to fight this extradition, which means Andrew and Tristan will likely, in an extradition case like this, which is federal, they're going to stay behind bars. They're going to be jailed at the Miami Federal Prison. I know that place. Used to cover it for months or perhaps even longer while they try to fight being sent back to the UK, the country where they are citizens. Will they be able to reach out to their 10 million or so followers while going through that process? Most likely not. So, in the United States right now, there is a severe shortage of elected officials who are beholden to their citizens, to people like me, who's an American citizen, right? But there are 2 members of Congress who are publicly arguing against the actions of 95% or more of their own colleagues, people in the Senate, people in Congress. However, while they disagree with their peers, Thomas Massie, Republican, Ro Khanna, Democrat, have the backing of 60% of the American people and 75% of the American people who happen to be under the age of 30 when it comes to saying that America needs to stop funding Israel. So recently, Khanna, who refuses to take campaign donations from Israel, went on a congressional fact-finding mission to Israel. While he was there, he was attacked by settlers who hate him, because he said that they've stolen land from Palestinians. The IDF was there, and they watched the settlers attack a congressman from the United States, from where, by the way, they get all of their weapons and their guns that they were using against Khanna. Now, this happened. I know it happened because I watched the video, right? It's on tape. It's irrefutable. But now look what happens when Ro Khanna appears on a cable news channel with an anchor who's obviously paid to defend Israel's point of view at all cost. You're going to watch as she's all but attacking him for daring to criticize the fact that he was attacked by settlers when he was in Israel.
Sir, why did you not coordinate with Israel on this, knowing they're staunch allies of the United States, knowing the recent history of the October 7th massacre? And most importantly, why did you decline to meet with Jewish survivors of the Hamas terror attacks on October 7th?
The ambassador is lying. We did inform
Israel. Sir, at a certain point, if everybody is lying, but just, sir, you have now said the ambassador is lying, the IDF is lying, the U.S. Embassy is lying. Who, at a certain point...
No, the U.S. Embassy I praised. I praised the U.S. Embassy. The ambassador is blatantly lying. There's a new video that came out. There's a body cam video for 1 minute and 30 seconds by an Israeli citizen, Nadav Wyman, who came out, who shows that the IDF...
Okay, we will take a look at that too, sir. We will take a look at that. But thank you for taking time with us this morning.
She's discarding him in attack. Could you imagine, right? If he was there and he was saying something happened to him while he visited Russia or Iran or, I don't know, Cuba or Venezuela or China, or pick your country... She would have been going, yay, I love you. You're doing great work. Thank you for saying those terrible things about that terrible countries, right? But he goes on the air and he explains something that happened to him in Israel. You would have think that he just admitted to raping a child or something, the way she's going after him, attacking him, lambasting him, not even giving him an opportunity to tell his story. This is what the media in America has become. This is what they call... journalism. Shameful. Meanwhile, the situation with the war in Iran is getting more dangerous and more expansive with each passing day. President Trump, along with Prime Minister Netanyahu, seem determined to continue, quote, bombing Iran into the Stone Ages. But apparently it's not working, at least not the way they want it to work, because Iran is firing back. Man, especially in places like Jordan, right? Bahrain as well. With surprising proficiency. Their missiles and their drones are getting through, and their rockets. Meanwhile, the more the U.S. continues hitting Iran, the more closed the Strait of Hormuz remains. Soon, the Strait of Al-Mandab in the Red Sea might be closed as well. The prospect of an expanded war is good news, by the way, for those who stand to make billions of increased off of the increased oil prices or the weapons sales or whatever. President Trump appears to be among those. But interestingly enough, his vice president, this is fascinating this weekend that I saw this, and I wanted to share it with you. Vice President J.D. Vance is publicly pushing back against this. Listen to his words.
I don't mind that the, let's say certain elements of the Israeli government want to criticize the deal or have disagreements about the deal. I don't even mind an effort to try to influence, foreign governments try to influence the United States all the time. You know, Israel does it. Other countries do it. It's just sort of the nature of the beast. What bothers me is actually when Americans allow, meaning American leadership, allows that influence to affect their judgment and to affect what they are advocating for. That's what really bothers me.
It bothers him when American leaders allow people from foreign countries to affect, right? Affect them or affect their leadership or affect their decision. What he just said is exactly what Miriam Adelson is doing and has done. It's exactly what Netanyahu is doing and has done. It's what billions of donations to the U.S. politicians over the years is used for. It's like, duh. At least he said it, though. And he's criticizing his boss, isn't he? I mean, directly or indirectly, that's what he's doing. By the way, this time, you might argue that the profiteering is different because on top of the political corruption that we're all used to, you know, from Israeli backers and war profiteers, there's something new. It's a new brand of profiteering that's taking place this time. In fact, this type of profiteering is so blatant that Iranians have actually brought it up while talking to U.S. negotiators. According to Drop Site News, you got to see this, Iranian negotiators are pointing to how much money Jared Kushner, Steve Witkoff, and others like them are making from the inside information they're getting when they meet with their Iranian counterparts. So with every promise or every stall in the talks or in the ceasefire or in the war, billions of dollars are made by the people who are in that meeting in those negotiations, or somebody in their family, et cetera, et cetera, when they short the oil, buy military stocks, or invest in predictive markets. You know how blatant the signs of the U.S. negotiators profiting from this inside information is? How blatant is it? It's so blatant that the Iranians are now asking the Americans for half the profits that they've made. Listen to this.
Before we suggest that the Iranians are like these, you know, upstanding, virtuous advocates of transparency, they actually told the mediators, and we reported this in the story too, that their estimate was that kind of Trump's circle, not just Witkoff and Kushner, but Trump's circle more broadly, had profited upwards of $9 billion from market manipulation throughout this process. And then they said, and so therefore we deserve 50% of it. which is pretty funny. And maybe it's maybe that's their opening bid.
Can you believe that? $9 billion just from being in these conversations. And then as soon as they leave the meeting, they pick up the phone and say, hey, here's what's about to happen. Place a bet. Invest in this. Short that. This is where we've gotten. All right. Here's the questions that we need to ask when we come back from the break. So what's going to happen now when a superpower keeps fighting a war that most experts say it cannot win? The Persian Gulf countries are getting pummeled right now. Can they convince the United States to stop? They're trying. And what happens in the United States? What happens in Israel? What happens in Russia? What happens? How are things going to change as a result of what we're seeing taking place right now, particularly with Iran, right? We're going to be joined by a futurist. Yes, a futurist. Chris Martinson is an economic researcher. He's an expert on energy in particular and resource depletion. And he's the co-founder of Peak Prosperity, peakprosperity.com, double P, C-O-M. We'll be right back. Hey, what do you say we talk to a futurist? Chris Martinson is one of those. He's joining us live now. He's an economic researcher. He's an expert on energy, by the way. And I'm going to throw him what in baseball we would call a softball, right? Something real easy to start because it happens to be in the news right now. It cleared just a little while ago, so I'm going to show you a headline. Look at this. The Houthis are saying that they're going to blockade the oil from Saudi Arabia. They're going to stop it. Do we have that, guys? Have we got that headline? This is the headline of the... There it is. Houthis announce immediate maritime blockade of Saudi Arabia. I guess for those of you who don't know, the Houthis, because it's in Yemen, is right next to the Strait of Al-Mandab, which is the entrance to the Red Sea, which leads into the Mediterranean. So that would probably be a pretty big deal. I mean, if the Strait of Hormuz is closed and the Strait of Al-Mandab is closed to Saudi oil... What is going to happen, Mr. Futurist?
What's going to happen? Oh, the softball. There's going to be a global economic catastrophe. It may be already unavoidable at this point. And that's simply because the world runs on oil and also derivative products. And the Gulf wasn't just oil. We talk oil. It's oil, oil, oil. But it's also all the oil products that come out of that, the precursors, also sulfur, helium, aluminum. There's so many things that are affected by this, and you can't call it a crisis. It's a poly-crisis at this point. The United States is playing with fire, and I don't see that we have any military options left because this weekend showed us something. We can't stop these next-generation missiles that Iran is lobbing right now.
How did we get to this point? I mean, I would have bet you. In fact, I went to Iran and I told the Iranians they were messing with fire. I even told them, and I've told them since. I've had conversations with some of the guys in the ministry, and I've said, you know, I thought you guys were going to be mincemeat. You have really, I'm sorry I doubted you, but you guys have put up a hell of a fight. I didn't expect it. Did you? Did anybody? Did you? I know you look at the future. Did you think they'd be able to do what they're doing?
Maybe to a point. I knew that trying to keep the Strait of Hormuz open militarily was always going to be an impossible challenge. Yeah. It's just geography plus the time. You know, even back 20 years ago, Iran had hypersonics or supersonic anti-ship missiles. They had the Sunburn back in the day. They got much better technology today. But I was totally surprised by how much they had been preparing for this moment. Mm. It tells you they're not going to like just go down for some, oh, we'll give you a couple billion and call it square, right? They've been building for this. They built their missiles specifically designed in these underground caverns and cities under mountains to withstand pretty much anything you could imagine throwing at them. And they have survived that. And I'm also very shocked by just how precise their missiles are. And the information that they've had early on in March, we had high quality information from sources I have that, you know, they would show these like, oh, here's a hotel in Bahrain. And it's got like this, this drone struck a spot. That was the spot where they knew exactly who was in that room. So they had really high quality intelligence as well. So,
and you know, and you know where it came from, right? Apparently, according to my reporting anyway on this, China. Apparently the Chinese gave them the most sophisticated satellite systems and equipment that exists on Earth right now. And that's what they've been using, apparently, that you just described. Do you know differently?
Yeah. No, I mean, I've heard that. I wouldn't be surprised if Russia was doing a little payback here as well, because obviously NATO and the U.S. have been giving all the targeting information that's allowed all the refineries to get struck and damaged, and also the Wildberries facilities, which is their Amazon. This is a two-front war. If it was just the Gulf, I'd be really alarmed, but it's Russia too, and they were, I've used this as a past tense, the number two exporter of crude and products in the world.
So I would think that looking at the future, things look good for Russia. Things look medium to good for China, I would imagine. From a money standpoint, for the big guys who run Exxon and Mobil and all these other big corporations in the West, things are going to be good for them as well. But as far as citizens in the United States, you know, my wife and my kids and you and your wife and your kids, it's not going to be good, right?
No, and we were coming into this kind of weak anyway, right? So if we look at the economy and energy are really linked concepts. And often economists get this wrong all the time. They think, oh, if you have a strong economy, the energy it's just an ignorable thing. It just comes along for the ride. But in fact, it's exactly opposite. If you have cheap and abundant energy, then you can have a robust economy. And so we're running out of that cheap and abundant part, and it's pretty dicey at this point. I know everybody's focused on the headline oil numbers. I believe they're being manipulated currently by this administration. But underneath that, when we look at the products, right, when we look at the prices for jet fuel, diesel, gasoline, all of those are shooting up, talking about a very, very tight situation in the world. And local mileage is going to vary. I think Europe is completely hosed in this story. They don't know it yet, but they'll figure that out. And poorer countries, just like poorer people in our country here in the U.S., those are the ones who get harmed the most.
You just said something which perked my ears up as a newsman. Obviously, I'm a journalist, and when I hear somebody say something like that, I need to get a better explanation for it. You think this administration is manipulating the oil prices. Explain.
I do. So the futures market is where the oil price is set. And the futures market's a paper market. You and I, Rick, we could trade barrels of oil all day long. You don't produce any, I don't consume any, or vice versa. But we're still contributing to setting the price. So what's been happening for the past several months now is that right in the dark of night, early in the morning, usually between 1 and 4 a.m., when there's very little trading, usually, typically, in those oil futures, we're seeing somebody come in at size and they're always mass sellers. And I'm not talking a little bit. They're sometimes in a single 1 minute window, they might dump as much as 600,000, 800,000, a million barrels of oil, all sold into that one tiny frame of time, which has an effect. It sets the price lower. So we've been watching this go on for a while, and I understand why they might be doing it. But the problem economically is that when you do that, you keep the price of oil too low, in the sense that with the price of oil low, demand stays high. And when demand is above supply, sooner or later you run out. And that's what we're seeing. We're watching the inventories crush down all across the world. But in the United States, Rick, we now have 43 days of oil in storage, but that's SPR and commercial inventories. 43 days. It's never been that low at any point in time since record keeping began. And it's just powering downward. Sooner or later, that becomes a crisis, and that's what we're all concerned about. We need this Strait of Hormuz opened, resolved a month ago. every week it carries on, it just multiplies the damage that's going to happen.
This person who may be doing this, or this entity, or whatever the hell it is that happens at between 1 and 4 in the morning consistently, is the motive political? In other words, we can't allow to have people in America paying $7 a gallon for gas because there's going to be hell, there's going to be fighting in the streets in the United States if something like that continues. Is that what the motive is? Or is it something else?
Of course. Yeah, it's absolutely the motive. We know that Trump really focuses on two things. If he may not care about a lot of things, but he deeply cares about stock prices and the price of oil. He mentions them all the time, yeah. Right? And so he cares about it. And because he cares about it, I think you can understand that sort of the spill down effect from there. I truly believe that, you know, with Scott Bessent in the Treasury position, he's very sophisticated, understands how markets work, understands how you would game this. And I could understand it even from a political standpoint. You say, look, we're pretty sure we're going to get this thing resolved. You might be deluding yourself, but we'll get this resolved soon. In the meantime, if we can just sort of cushion this price over here a little bit, that'll make things smoother for Americans, for our political careers. There's a lot of reasons you could rationalize it. But at some point, you have to go, oh, our assumption about this being over soon was wrong. And we're about to steam headlong into what's called tank bottoms, where we actually, it's going to be a huge crisis. I mean, a price shock is worse than an eventual price rise because there's no gradual adjustment to it.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. It's almost like a tsunami effect, right? Like a sudden, like a tectonic shift that suddenly, boom, the price all of a sudden is going to go from wherever the hell it is now, 80 to back up to 120 or higher then. That would be... That would be crazy. Now, explain to our audience, because I don't understand it, how the oil reserves work. And my understanding is that those things are really kicking in right now, not just on part of the United States, but other countries around the world. How much of that is out there? How long does it last? And what's the effect when we do get to the bottom of that?
Well, each country has to make its own decision. So China had enormous apparent reserves, if you can believe the numbers. And honestly, I take every number I hear these days with a little bit of salt, but yeah, they had enormous reserves, 1.2 to 1.4 billion barrels. The United States has a capacity in its strategic petroleum reserve, the SPR, for 713 million barrels. But Biden sold a bunch of that off in 2022. Trump started to refill it a tiny bit, then started selling it off hard. So we're down at about 300 million barrels-ish there right now. And there's questions as to how much lower we can really go before, well, you have to worry about, like, that's supposed to be in reserve for a real crisis, like a hurricane that takes out a lot of your refineries all of a sudden, or your Gulf platforms, or a war. Yeah. So at some point, we're going to get down to a level where it would be recklessly irresponsible to go any lower than that. Plus, there's a level in there somewhere where you start actually damaging the salt caverns. We keep our strategic petroleum in holes in the ground all along the Gulf Coast, right? Yeah. Salt domes that were carved out. Japan keeps theirs in above ground stores, China mostly in above ground stores. So it's just a different sort of a process there for them. They can draw down a lot further, but everybody's drawing their reserves down right now. Europe, Japan, US, how much longer can it go? It's a little bit of a political conversation. And then there is some hard limit in there, but honestly, you'd be foolish under this environment to go below a certain level, because if you run out of oil, if you get to actual shortages, now that, Rick, that's pure chaos. Can you imagine, like, under COVID, we had CDC and CSIS telling us who was essential and who wasn't? You know, can you imagine California regulators deciding who gets diesel and who doesn't? It would just be a hot mess.
Well, that's why I'm glad you're here, because it seems like you've got very cogent explanations for some of this stuff that makes an average guy like me or people watching understand it. And I've had, since, you know, we reach out to lots of people, and I've interviewed a lot of brilliant people on this show, and most of them tell me something akin to what you are describing, that we are on the verge of a catastrophe. What is coming down the pike here, if this thing doesn't get fixed, is going to be really bad. In fact, most of them tell me it's already inevitable, that it can't be stopped, that we're going to get hit. So I keep looking at the actual story, and I don't see it. Everybody says it's coming, but I don't see the signs of it, at least because I don't have the experience, perhaps, that you do. Can you make us understand what they mean, or what perhaps you mean, by the inevitability of this so-called catastrophe?
Yeah, I think, you know, if I had a chart I could show you, it's one of my favorite charts, right? And it's the x-axis, the y-axis, we're plotting GDP, economic activity on one axis, and then oil consumption on the other axis. Uh-huh. You know what you get when you put all the different countries on there? You get a straight line. And the reason you get that straight line is that if you want to have a larger economy, you're going to be burning more oil. And that makes sense when you sort of look at it that way, right?
Because you're more productive.
Economic activity.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, more flights, more trucks, more things happening, more mines mining, more people going to stores, taking vacations.
Yeah.
Every one of those things burns oil. So the last, if the strait gets entirely closed down, if this is why this last weekend was so alarming to everybody who's watching it carefully, is that Iran had said, look, if you go past a certain threshold, we are now going to start targeting actual infrastructure in and around the Gulf Coast, including things they've laid off of so far, say the Al Abqaiq refinery in Saudi Arabia or Kuwait's main loading terminal, right? Well, that loading terminal just got hit because the United States decided to hit some fairly significant infrastructure inside around their red line. Okay. If that gets closed down entirely, yeah. So let's just imagine, sake of argument, 1 year, we don't get any oil out of the Gulf. I know it's extreme, but just to make the point. If that's true, the world has to figure out for the next year how to get by on about 25% less oil than it did before the strait got closed.
25%.
So now we ask the question.
That's a big number.
Now we ask the question.
Yeah.
When did the world last burn 25% less oil on that little line chart I talked about? And we just draw a line, go back and say, oh, 2011. Next question. Well, how big was the economy in 2011 globally? Oh, it was 36% smaller. That's what's at risk here. That is an impossibility to manage with quadrillions in derivatives, approaching $40 trillion in debt in the U.S. The whole thing, we're talking now, this spills over into the financial systems, monetary policy and systems. I don't know if it's controllable at that point.
And who would suffer the most?
The average person. The United States is really, I think, we've always been the strongest sort of fort in the storm, but we'll do pretty badly, but we're going to do relatively well because we still have a lot of oil coming out of shale. And by the way, we import a bunch of oil still, but we get it from Canada and also Venezuela. So we're kind of regionally dialed in here. Europe is in deep trouble in this story, and a lot of Asia is in deep trouble. And of course, the weaker countries in really bad shape. Pakistan, Bangladesh, India would be in very bad shape because, again, as I mentioned, this isn't just the oil, it's the derivative products. And of those, it's the amount of fertilizer that's not being produced coming out of the nitrogen fertilizer because the gas plants in Qatar have been knocked out or are offline because they can't ship it right now. And as well, we're missing the sulfur. So we're starting to miss the phosphate fertilizer. And the United States is already had to do an emergency import of phosphate from Morocco, but Morocco is not getting the sulfuric acid it needs to do this. There's all sorts of stuff going on. And as well, in Russia right now, they are the world's number one wheat exporter, and they're having trouble harvesting their wheat in certain areas because they've had so much difficulty with their fuel supplies because of all of the attacks that the United States has openly admitted, well, we're helping target.
I heard Mr. Rubio, guy I grew up with, say that recently. And of course, in London and in Berlin and in Paris, you know, those guys are jumping for joy. Yay, we're punishing the Russians. And it's like, it seems silly, by the way, because it's kind of like a civilian thing that they're kidding mostly in this case. By the way, let me switch over and go over to China. I read last Friday night or Thursday, I can't remember, that China had decided to reduce its imports of oil. Is this just a benevolent thing, or are they being smart, seeing what's coming because they're good at looking? The Chinese are kind of like futurists in their own way, aren't they?
Ooh, yeah, this is a great question. And unfortunately, all I can really do is speculate. We know that Trump went over with a bunch of big head CEOs from U.S. Techland, right, on May 13th, right? And so something happened immediately after that. China dialed back its imports by a whopping 4 to even 5 million barrels per day.
Damn.
For the next month and a half, right? Mm-hmm. That was enormous. It helped keep the pressure off the system. They're eating into the reserves. So there must have been some quid pro quo. I know what the quid was, right? China said, okay, we'll do this. But you know China, right? They're going to get something out of it. I don't know what that was. So we can all speculate, but I have to wonder what that pro quo side of that equation was. But China has recently started re-importing. And also, they're starting to make active noises here because if the United States really ruins the whole Gulf region exports for a while. That hits the Pacific basin. That hits China. That hits Asia. That's who really gets harmed the most.
Let's go back to Russia, because I'm trying to understand that situation a little bit better. Russia has more oil than God. I mean, obviously I jest, but they really do. They've got as much hydrocarbons as anybody out there. And sure, you know, Zelensky and company and the Europeans can hit a refining plant and make people have to wait in line for a while. But in the end, I would think, right? I'm not an expert, but I would think it would be hard for Russia not to end up a winner in the long run in this stupid game that's being played right now in Iran. Am I right?
Well, absolutely. You know, Russia's very good at persevering and picking themselves up again. So they'll get past all of this. But when they do, I can't imagine that anything other than almost a permanent rupture of relationships with Europe is done, right? I think Putin has been fairly restrained, and he's constantly said, look, we'd rather be friends with y'all than not. Europe won't take no for an answer, you know, and just continues to insist that Russia's the enemy. The problem is Europe is just not thinking this through. Right now, Europe's natural gas stores that they have are right at the bottom, like they're where they at the total bottom end of a 10-year range, like kind of as low as they've ever been. And how are they going to refill them? Right. Well, there's all this LNG missing. 20% of the world's exported LNG is missing from Qatar. Everybody's competing for it. There just isn't enough elsewhere to make up. LNG producers don't just ramp up 20% and call it a day. So they're facing huge shortages. Right. All they would have to do is come up with a political rapprochement with Russia, and they could actually reopen one of the two Nord Stream pipelines.
Yes.
Wasn't damaged. Russia said, well, we would be happy to open that. This would solve their problems, but Europe is going to literally sacrifice its people and its industries, German heavy industry, heavy energy-dependent industry, is collapsing. It's at Great Depression level. This is down 23% from its recent highs.
Is that false pride? I mean, what? It's almost like... Like Chris, if your family were going hungry, you know, your kids couldn't eat, and I was your neighbor, and I came over and I said, look, I know you're going through a hard time, Chris. Suzanne and I have decided we're going to make dinner for your kids every night so you don't have to worry about it. And you essentially just shot me a bird and said, get out of my house. I don't want you here. That almost feels like what Germany is doing with Russia. Russia's saying, we've got cheap oil. You can have it. We can get this thing going here. And they're saying, no, get off my front porch. What is that?
It's exactly what's happening. I don't know. You know, Europe seems to go completely insane every so often. And I think they're approaching another one of their insane moments here. So they're already in deep trouble. But after the dust settles, it's not like Russia's needs them as an export market. Obviously, no. China is going to start building pipelines and said, hey, we'll take all of that. China has a brilliant five-year plans or 25-year plan. And in each one of those, they clearly talk about where they want their kids to be, how they're going to be educated, health, all this. But their energy policy makes perfect sense, right? And part of that is being friendly with everybody who's selling them energy, because that's sensible.
Yeah, this new Siberian pipeline. I was in Beijing, and I was there with I wasn't there with them, but I was covering them. But I was there when Mr. Modi and Mr. Xi and Mr. Putin got together, that famous little ditty they did together, holding hands or whatever the hell that was, trying to send a picture to the world that we're unified or whatever it is. But during that meeting, they signed this deal to do two big Siberian pipelines that from now on, the Russians are saying, OK, we tried the Nord Stream pipeline. We were going to send all of our resources, our hydrocarbons, into Europe, but the Europeans don't want it. So now we're going to redirect those into China. And they're also doing deals with India as we speak. How big is that?
Well, it's a huge deal. And, you know... If you study history, you find that pipelines get built and then wars seem to sort of magically show up there a year or two later because energy is the master resource, right? This is strip away all the gobbledygook. It's about democracy, human rights. None of that matters. This is about who controls the energy, controls the world's power. And so this has always been a point of contention. China, last time I was there, I was talking with a fairly high-level person. He said, you know, Chris, the business of China is business, and the business of the United States is war. They're two different approaches, but we just feel like If we go out with our magic checkbooks and people get a new library and a port and a rail system and we get what we want, this makes sense to us, right? So their five-year plan, their energy plan, talks specifically about their relationships with energy producers and how they have to keep those happy and stable, right? So they're going to win that war, by the way.
Yeah, Iran is, you mean. Iran?
Well, yep, Iran, but no, China's going to end up winning that war.
Sorry.
I think when the dust settles here, what happens is China has much more influence over that whole region. The United States is badly diminished, if not entirely ejected.
So before we run out of time, let me stop you then, because I like where you're going here. China's going to end up on top. Let's go, and I'm going to go through Iran, Russia, United States, Israel, maybe Persian Gulf countries. Let's start next with Iran. Where will Iran end up after all this is said and done, given how it's looking now?
Much elevated. They're going to have a lot more influence in the region. They're going to be an obvious power broker, and other surrounding countries are going to have to make deals with them.
Israel.
Israel's really not doing itself any favors here. They are going to be badly diminished, and they are obviously risking, I think, existentially, I think Israel's risking everything for reasons that are absolutely unclear to me. You can't just fight everybody around you all the time and expect that to work out. So Israel's going to be in deep trouble here.
Persian Gulf countries, too many to name, but as a whole or any in particular that you want to talk about that may be up or down when this is all done?
I think when all this is said and done, they're going to have to find a way to operate as, you know, they've been pushing feelers out, the GCC, right? The Gulf Coast Council. So they're going to have to operate more as a unit. They will. I don't know if this is going to mean they set aside Shia Sunni to become more Arabs than, you know, individual subsects, but they're going to have to unify. Obviously, they're sitting on the prize. The last best cheap oil in the world is right there.
Russia?
Russia's going to get banged up here for a bit, but I think they're going to end up turning, just finally washing their hands of the West. You know, they've said it clearly. They've said, look, you guys are run by pedophiles and, you know, other things like that, where they just feel like there's a moral decay in the West that they wish wasn't there, is my sense, but they can't figure out how to change that. And they're such pragmatic people. I think they keep thinking, we wouldn't do that. We would wake up before that happens. And they keep getting disappointed.
I play golf with Russians every weekend, and it's weird because deep down they want so much to be loved by the Europeans and the Americans, because deep down they want to be like Europeans and Americans. They love Europeans and Americans. They'd rather be friends with Europeans and Americans more so than they would be with the Indians and the Chinese. But they're starting to realize that no matter what we do, we put our hand out and they basically slap it away and kick us in the teeth. And that's starting to be more visible, that realization, if you get my drift.
I totally do. And I share that summary. And I have a great time with Russians, and I don't understand why they're such an existential enemy to the United States and always have been, you know?
Why do we hate them? It's like, we're silly. And they've never even asked us for anything other than friendship. And yet it's like, you'd think, all right, finally, your country, my country, we're Americans. What, this is crazy what we're going through right now. How the hell does this end up, Chris?
Well, now I think we're in a deeply weakened state because of policies that the Federal Reserve has pursued aggressively over the past 15, 20 years. We have this extraordinary wealth gap. We have all this financialization. People make money with money. And it's all predicated on just ever increasing amounts of debt. Listen, the way you pay debt off in the future is with future economic activity and growth. Where's that going to come from if energy is super expensive? Where's that going to come from with AI, whole separate subject? But, you know, that is a force that's going to come and take lots of jobs away. Already is. And I don't see how we get growth out of that. I see how we get degrowth out of that, to be honest.
I got to ask you then. I know that was supposed to be the final question, but let me ask you, is the dollar done?
This is the Roach Motel. The dollar's going to, you're going to see an apparent relative strengthening of the dollar because people are going to unwind all these international cross-border carry trade kind of things, but it'll go up for a bit. I think that's the Roach Motel. That's the last swan. We are geared to ruin the dollar as a currency unit, and that's just the trajectory we're on.
It's just going to happen, but it's not going to happen right away, I hear you saying. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, how did Hemingway go broke? Slowly, then all at once. This will speed up at the end.
Yeah, he drank too much. He got high on, he got, what did Tony Montana say? He got high on his own supply. Chris, by the way, you got to visit the Hemingway Museum in Key West. It's one of the most beautiful things you'll ever see. Chris Martinson, you're fantastic, man. Thanks so much. If people want to reach out to you, where do they go?
They go to peakprosperity.com, which you mentioned at the beginning. Twitter, it's my name, Chris Martinson. Just that's my handle, at Chris Martinson. So, and I'm all over YouTube. I'm everywhere.
Peakprosperity.com. And we are done. And we're out of time. And so is my voice. So I'm going to say adieu for now. Thanks so much for being with us. And we'll look for you next time.
Thank you.
Wow.